You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
Sorry, come on.
I'm sorry.
No, I can't let you in. Sorry.
Alice, is this cool?
Yeah, come on in.
Sorry to bother you, but we'd have to come and tell you how much we really enjoyed the show, didn't we, Garth?
Oh, thanks.
We're not mental or anything, so don't be afraid. My name is Wayne, and this is Garth.
Nice to meet you guys.
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Miliwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of Milwaukee is the fact that it's the only major American city to have ever elected 3 socialist mayors.
Does this guy know how to party or what?
Okay.
Well, we gotta get going.
No. Stick around. Hang out with us.
Cool. Yeah, we'll stay and hang around with us. With Alice Cooper.
But it's cool. I'm allowed to go here. It's all good. I'm okay. I'm allowed to go up here. It's cool. Okay. I got my. It's all good. Okay. I'm good. I belong here. Okay. Okay. All right. I'm good. I'm allowed to go up here. All right. This is backstage pass. So hold on a second. Now I'm backstage. When I was in high school, I had the opportunity, we were in, and I probably shared some of this story before, I was in the marching band in our school. You can back me down a little bit more, Isaac. I don't know, I'm just so loud. I was in the marching band in my high school, and in my freshman year of high school, we went to Orlando, Florida, and our marching band was in the Walt Disney World Parade, which is kind of awesome. And it was really wild. One thing that wasn't so awesome is that I grew up in Delaware, which obviously is not quite as... I didn't say I grew up in Oregon or something like that. anyway, it's not quite as north as Pennsylvania, but, you know, we still get, it's cold there, and we have a football season, and that's what marching band was for. And so we had these thick polyester marching band uniforms that we would wear during the football season. And then we went down to this parade in April in Orlando, Florida, and we sweated like crazy. It was so hot. But what was really wild about it is that they took our bus, the school buses, the band bus, we went in like this special entrance at the Magic Kingdom, and we went in the back, and we actually had to sign a waiver as we were on the bus saying we will not take pictures. Now, nobody had like cameras like you do today. Like, we'd have to get out and be like, hold on, click, click. Click. Oh, I'm out of film. And if you are a certain age or older, that makes total sense. The rest of you are like, what just happened there? And that's okay. That's okay. But anyway, we weren't allowed to take pictures because we were behind the scenes at the Magic Kingdom. And there was just like, there were all this secret roads. I keep losing my mic. There were secret roads that were there. And just like, you didn't even know. They're right there behind like Adventureland and Fantasyland. And we got to see all these backstage things, which was really cool. And then we ended up, you know, they had a gate that opened, and we kind of made our way into the park as we were playing and walked down Main Street and in parade formation. It was really cool. But we got to see backstage, and all of you, I don't know if you've ever, anybody ever had a backstage pass for anything or for an event or anything like that? How we hit the house lights here, T? A couple of you, I said that, try it again. I like some of you. All right. The thing about a backstage pass is that, of course, it gives you pretty much unlimited access to areas that are otherwise off limits. I mean, that's the idea of a backstage pass. It lets you go somewhere where normally you're not allowed to go. And the thing about a backstage pass is that, you know, unlike the ones that you have around you that were homemade, you can't just, you know, decide that you're going to have your own. You can't just kind of make it your own and show up. Someone has to grant it to you. You can't just go behind the scenes. Someone has to say, hey, take this backstage pass, just like Wayne and Garth there from 1992 Wayne's World. I would not recommend the movie, but that scene was quite funny as they, you know, showed their backstage passes everywhere to go meet with Alice Cooper. But the pass has to be given to you. And the other thing about the pass is that not only does it have to be given to you, but you have to use it. You can't just leave it at home and then say, oh, I'm going to go backstage. You can't just show up and be like, oh, no, it's cool. I've got one at home. You've got to actually have it, and you've got to use it to get to those off-limit areas. And so as we continue this series, we're going to see that Jesus' death on the cross has offered us backstage access to an off-limit area, off-limits area. To a place that once upon a time no one could ever go to. And we've already talked about it, but we'll come back to it again. And the point that we're going to look at this morning as we go through this series on the temple is that the torn curtain brought the people to God. Last week we talked about how the temple brought God to his people. This week we're talking about how the torn curtain brings the people to God, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. And if you heard the passage, it was already read, we're going to come back to that. And if you paid attention last week, you're probably like, oh, I know where we're going. But this series, we're looking at the temple throughout the Bible. And last week we looked at the temple, which was the tabernacle, which was a temporary temple, a temporary place where the people could meet with God, where God came to the earth to meet with his people. And that was unique. And again, that's what we talked about last week. That was unique among any other faith, any other religion, where people were always trying to get to God. God said, I'm going to come and dwell among you. I'm going to come, and the Hebrew word that translated in our English is, I'm going to come and tabernacle among you. I'm going to come and be with your people. And we talked about this thing last week that I totally made up. We just sang a song called Emmanuel, God with Us. This thing I created called the Emmanuel Scale. And Emmanuel means God with us. And so last week, the tabernacle, when it comes to the Emmanuel scale, was fair. It was fair. It wasn't amazing. It was fair. You know, maybe 2 out of 5 stars. But now as we look at this next level of this torn curtain, the Emmanuel scale now is good. It's good. We're probably looking at 3, 3.5 to stars and, you know, out of 5. But it's pretty good. And you're like, wait, this sounds like amazing. Why is it just good? We'll get there. Stick with us for the next couple of weeks. But we were looking at the tabernacle, which was the way that the people worshiped God. God came to them and said, here are the standards for worship. And so today I want to talk about the permanent temple. And we're looking at what we are calling the temples. Because biblically, there were 3 temples. That's why there's a 3 in the middle of the E. That wasn't a typo. There were 3 temples that we're going to see that you'll find in the Bible. And I'm going to spend most of my time on the first one because the other ones were kind of redos, if you will, of that. And the first temple that we see was built by Solomon. Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was, for Jewish people, was known as the Great Temple. Now, we're going to see that the third temple was actually bigger and better, but for kind of different reasons. This was the one. This was the original temple. This was the one that God told his people to build for him. And the tabernacle up to this point had lasted for about 400 years since God gave Moses the instructions on Mount Sinai, about 1446, 1500, the other way around. 1300 B.C. to build the tabernacle. So it was around for about 400 years. And just to catch you up on where we are, and we talked about this last week, we did a series a couple months ago called The Story, which was an overview of the entire Bible. And just to help you place where we are, because we're going to be bouncing through the story this morning, I just want to give you a couple of reminders from that. So here we are in the story. This was taking place in what we call Chapter 6, which was coronation. And that was the time of the kings. And again, that was a crown, not a 3-webbed, fingered, toed, sloth or something like that. But that was the crown and the coronation, the era of the kings. And when we talked about this, and again, this is review. You can go back and listen to it. There's a slide on the slideshow where you can find that. But the review is that we talked about Saul for 40. Saul was the first king of Israel. He reigned for 40 years. And then David reigned for 40 years. David was the next king. And then David's son, Solomon, reigned for 40 years. So an interesting thing about David is David said, you know, God, we are now in this city called Jerusalem. David actually purchased the land that would become the place where the temple is. And he said, God, you know, I want to build you a temple. And one of the things that David did during his reign, as you probably are well aware, whether you've gone to church before or never ever, is that David started his, you know, kind of popularity with a battle. He beated this really tall guy named Goliath. And so David's reign was marked by a lot of war, kind of bringing the nation of Israel back to God, getting rid of the nations that shouldn't have been there. And so he said, I want to build you a temple. And God said, no, there's too much blood on your hands. But as an honor to you, I will allow your son to build the temple. And so this is a big deal. Like to us, we don't quite get that as much, but biblically, especially in Hebrew culture, the Jewish culture, that's having your child be able to do something was actually more valuable than you doing it yourself. And so he said, I'm going to let your son build it. And so David did all the prep, got the instructions from God, started getting things together so that there would be a permanent temple where the people can worship God. Again, the tabernacle was temporary. It was a tent. It was a tent that was made of fabric and wood that was taken down. And we didn't really talk about this too much, but every one of the pieces in the tabernacle had long poles through it so that they could pick it up and carry it to the next spot as they were eventually wandering their way through the desert for 40 years till they made it to the promised land. And then there was a 400 years of judges. So there's a long time from when God gave the instruction to when it was time to build this permanent place. So the temple was the permanent place. And we find the temple in 1 Kings chapters 5 through 8, and then 2 Chronicles chapters 2 through 11. Just to pause and give you another reminder that 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, those four books, 1 Samuel through 2 Kings, were written in parallel with 1 and 2 Chronicles. So 1 and 2 Chronicles shares the same stories that you would read in 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. However, Chronicles only talks about the Jewish southern kingdom and not about the northern kingdom of Israel, which you would find in the other one. So that's just a side note. But it was built in, you find the instructions here. And just to give you some comparison from last week, and you've got this in the YouVersion notes, which I didn't even mention for you to download. I hope you guys got that. Do you need the QR code? Anybody need that QR code for the YouVersion notes? Because there's another chart. I'm not getting any yeses, so because I can bring it back. Okay, so here was the tabernacle. We looked at that last week, and we talked about the pieces that were inside of it. This is just the inside. And I made this next diagram to scale for the most part. So there's the tabernacle. Here's the temple. So can I jump back there for a second? Tabernacle, that's what the size of the tabernacle was. And now that's the size of the temple. The temple was much, much bigger. Interestingly enough, the temple had the same dimensions that the tabernacle did, just on a bigger scale. Oh, you know what? Can you run my pointer up to me? It's right there on the little bag on the side there, on the hook there. Yeah, someone run. Because I got my pointer, and I wanted to, oh, man. It's hanging in a little bag right on the hook right there. It's not back there. It's right next to you. It's right there. That's still not it. Nope. That's a bag. No. Is that someone's leftovers from dinner? No. All right. Now I have my pointer. Thank you, sir. Oh, there. Yeah, there's my pointer. Okay, cool. Now I'm like really official because I've got a pointer. By the way, I know it's really warm in here because that's what happens when it's like suddenly 65. The heat is not actually running. So just so you know. So the temple, this is actually the temple building proper. And it is much bigger than the tabernacle was. And there were some things that are almost identical. So I'm going to go through this quickly. You do have a kind of a chart in those YouVersion notes about this. I'm going to go through it quickly because all of the things are almost the same, just kind of biggie size, just a little bit bigger. And some of them are just a little bit bigger. But for what it's worth, these two items here are in the courtyard. And the courtyard, the temple courtyard, instead of having a fence made out of fabric, it was a wall because it's a permanent building. And then outside of this courtyard, which you can't even see on the screen here, were more courtyards. There was actually a whole complex of courtyards. And some of them were the court of the Gentiles, where anybody that was not Jewish could be in there. There were certain courts for just women because women weren't allowed in the court of men. There were the outer courts. There was the priestly courts. So there was a whole bunch of different courts, and I'm not going to get into all that right now. But just so you know, when you get to Jesus, and it talks about him going into the temple courts and turning over the tables, that was part of this whole complex. And it was huge. It was the highest point in Jerusalem. And that's why it's called Mount Zion. Zion was the name for Jerusalem. It was at the top of this mountain. And so what we're looking at here is just kind of the basic immediate structure. And for those of you that did not get the jump starter last week, you're going to want to pick it up out there at the table, the Ignition, the MC3 family check-in table, because there's a physical model that you guys can build. So a couple things here. Let me just go in order here. The inner courtyard here, we had the altar, and just to give you some perspective, the tabernacle altar was about 7.5 feet square, and this one was 30 feet square, 30 feet by 30 feet, so much bigger, and then the tabernacle altar was 4.5 feet high off of the ground. This one was 15 feet off of the ground. That's why there's stairs there. And again, as we talked about last week, which we'll come back to it, but I'm not going to review too much, this is where they would sacrifice the animal on behalf of their sins. A person would come forth and sacrifice an animal. And then down here we have the laver, and if you notice, the laver used to be over there in the tabernacle. It's also called the sea, and I mentioned this a little bit last week. It was 15 feet wide and 7 feet deep. It's basically a swimming pool. And they say it held around 16,500 gallons of water. We also find out that there were portable lavers for washing. And again, if you weren't here last week, the priests would have to wash themselves before they could perform or even go into the tabernacle or temple. And they say that this probably wasn't actually used from a practical sense. It was probably just the portable ones, but it was really awesome. And they called it the sea, the great sea. And then as you come in, there's like a little court, a little entrance porch, they would call it there, and there were two big bronze columns that were there, and you'd have to go up to it. This was all raised above that, and then this whole court was raised above the next part. Like, everything was getting higher and higher because it was meant to honor God as a way to say God is above everything. So you'd come in, and then the holy place here, and the most holy place, this is the holy place in this area, and the reason it's different from this area is because there was a temple veil or a curtain that was between the two. And now, so you know, the tabernacle was, what did I say, it was 15 feet high. The temple was 30 feet high. And then later we're going to see Herod's temple, the one that was at Jesus' time, was 60 feet tall. So there was this veil that went from top to bottom. It was about 3 inches thick. It was woven fabric. And the priests would come in and they would serve in here, but they were not allowed to enter the most holy place because that is where they say where God's presence dwelt. But before we get to that, I want to share a couple of things. If you notice, there's an area out here. The temple, they had rooms built around the outside where the priests would live and they would store things. So there's all that stuff. So going back to the front here, so the priests would come in, they have to wash themselves, and in here in the holy place, they would go every day. Only the priests could go in, only after purifying themselves, only after, you know, with a sacrifice, the blood of an animal. If you're like, why are you going so fast? Because I spent last week talking about all this in depth. So you can go to mc3church.org/temple and listen and watch. So the holy place was this outer area, two-thirds. And the tabernacle had an altar of incense, and it's the same altar of incense for all intents and purposes. The tabernacle had one lampstand and one table. Well, the temple has 10 lampstands and 10 tables. So again, just kind of biggie size. And again, you can go back to last week to find out what the table represented. The lampstands were there for light and also to represent the tribes. And so then, once a year, on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, Kippur means to cover over or to atone, the high priest, only one priest, could go in there with the blood of an animal, and he would go in through the veil and go into the most holy place. And in the most holy place, or also called the Holy of Holies, was the Ark of the Covenant, which was a large glass box, gold box, and we talked about it last week, and that inside that was the Ten Commandments, and actually at this point, Aaron's staff is no longer there because it had just disintegrated. It was a wooden staff, 400 years, it'll do that. And the jar of manna had also kind of fallen apart, but the Ten Commandment tablets were in there. And then there were two, this was different from the temple, there were two huge cherubim statues that Solomon built. And they were so gigantic that their wings touched each other. So it was 15 feet wingspan for each, 30 feet across that they touched, and they were in there. And as we said last week, anytime you see the cherubim, it represents God's holiness. God's holiness is somehow connected to the cherubim. And so the temple veil had cherubim all over the side of it. So this was the temple. This was a permanent place where the people would come and worship. And again, you're like, wow, he just went so fast. Wow, I'm not following that. Wow, you should have been here last week. So that's what the temple is, a permanent place where the people would come and worship God. And we'll come back to some of this in a little bit. But just to give you a picture, here is a photo that was taken. This was back when they had film cameras. And they took this photo. It was actually after they recorded the video that we watched last week that they recorded at the tabernacle. But just as a comparison, here's the tabernacle and the things we talked about last week, cut in from the side. There's your fence. Here's the temple court wall around there. And then here's the temple itself. And as you notice, everything, there's stairs there. You go up, 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 and you can see the cutaway of the rooms there. And there's the giant cherubim. So the temple was much bigger. So it was a permanent place where people worshiped God. Okay. that was so fast. But without repeating what we all talked about last week. So the thing about the temple, is that once Solomon finished constructing this thing, which was just an amazing place, it was the center for worship. A little bit later, you're going to hear about synagogues in the Bible. But the synagogue was not the center of worship. That was basically like a classroom for Jewish people. But the temple was the place. There was one temple. And people would come once a year if it was time for the Day of Atonement or time to do their sacrifices. They would come to Jerusalem. They would make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which was a city on the top of a mountain. And at the top of the mountain was the temple on top of that. So it was a high location. And if you read, just as a side note, this is bonus because you're like, I'm so excited about more information. That if you read some of the Psalms, it'll say at the top, a psalm of ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T. And those psalms of ascent, when you read through the book of Psalms, they were psalms that are songs that were sung as people were going to worship. That was the temple. That was a song that they would sing as they ascend to Jerusalem. And so that was something they would sing there. So that's bonus there. So you find this there. But one of the things we saw last week is once they built the tabernacle, it said that God's presence filled it. And from that moment on, above the ark, no one could go back there because the glory of God dwelled there. And the glory of God was so amazing, so perfect, so beyond who we are. A sinful human could never be in the presence without dying, just instant death. And we talked about Moses and how he said, I want to see your glory. And God said, you can't see my glory and live. You know, I'll let you get a little bit of the mist of my glory after it goes by. It's just not possible to survive there. And like we said last week, it's not like there were snipers on the roof taking out somebody that would go into the Holy of Holies. It was God's glory, just instant. That's just what happened because his glory is so incredible. So that was the tabernacle. Well, we see here, once the temple was built in 2 Chronicles, there is a passage here that records what happens there in chapter 5, verses 13 to 14, and this is in your notes there. It says, the trumpeters and musicians, and this is talking about the big worship celebration. It's the grand opening ceremony for the temple. The trumpeters and musicians joined in unison to give praise and thanks to the Lord, accompanied by trumpets, cymbals, and other instruments. The singers raised their voice in praise to the Lord and sang, He is good. His love endures forever. And it's interesting. We're going to hear that again later. And then it says, then the temple of the Lord was filled with the cloud. And the cloud was the glory of the Lord cloud. And the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple of God. And so now the glory of the Lord is in the temple. And as we said last week, we cannot be in the presence of God's glory. Paul says it this way, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And so now God's glory is in the temple. So just so you know, this is God going like, yep, this is my place now. Tabernacle, we're done with that. Okay? And so the glory of the Lord was over the temple, and his presence was in the Holy of Holy Place. And what's interesting is that at one point, and this is also a bonus, Jerusalem was attacked. And this is before the temple was built. Jerusalem was attacked during the time of Saul, and when he was king. And then they actually, the Philistines took the ark from the temple. And all of the nation of Israel was just in bitter, like wept, because like that's where God is. God is there. He's above the ark. And it says that the Philistines actually stored the ark in a room with all their other idols. And every morning they woke up and all their idols had fallen down in worship to the ark, which is really kind of cool. So anyway, the glory of the Lord was a big deal in all of this. This is where people worship. But then, if you go through the story of Kings, and we did a series called King Me. We also did a story called, our series called Word 3, Kings and Prophets, where we walk through the different kings that you find in the Bible. After, how many years did I say this went? After 350 years. So about 350 years, the temple was eventually destroyed by Babylon. And if you remember the story as we talked through it, that the Babylonians came in and took the Israelites, the southern kingdom of Judah specifically, took them into captivity. And it's interesting because at the end of the book of Kings, you read about these different kings that kept turning away from God, And God said, look, with the prophets, you need to get right or I'm going to do something. You're going to repent or regret. Maybe you guys remember that. Repent, turn back to me, or you're going to regret it. And they were like, nah, God, we can do it our own way. We can do it our own way. We're all good. We're good. And the kings kept getting worse and worse and further away from God. And God was like, look, I'm going to take my glory away from the temple. And they're like, no, your glory's always been here. It's been here for hundreds of years, almost 1,000 years. And one of these prophets was a guy named Ezekiel, and he shares this vision. This is near the end of the kings of Israel. And in Ezekiel chapter 10 there, he says, then he's sharing this vision of what is about to happen. If you guys don't change, this is going to happen. It says, then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. And then it says that eventually the glory of the Lord left the temple. This was a vision of what was going to happen. Change your hearts, change yourself, get back to God, Israel, southern kingdom of Judah. And they're like, nah, nah, we're good. No, I'm fine. And then in 586 BC, we read this in 2 Kings chapter 25. It says, in August the 14th of that year, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, his reign, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard and an official of the Babylonian king arrived in Jerusalem. So finally, the Babylonians are in this city, and it says he burned down the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, which was right next to the temple, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He destroyed all the important buildings in the city. And then jumping a little bit further on, it says the Babylonians broke up the bronze pillars in front of the Lord's temple, the bronze water carts, and the great bronze basin called the sea. And they carried all the bronze away to Babylon. They also took all the ash buckets, shovels, lamp snuffers, ladles, and all the other bronze articles used for making sacrifices at the temple. The captain of the guard also took the incense burners and basins and all the other articles made of pure gold or silver. They're like, we're in charge now. You got lots of money. We're taking it with us. We're taking your bronze. We're taking your gold. We're taking your silver. We don't care what it's for. We just want the goods. And it said the weight of the bronze from the two pillars, the sea and the water carts, was too great to be measured. These things had been made for the Lord's temple in the days of Solomon. So the end of Solomon's temple, that was it. It was destroyed. And so then that's the first temple. Then we have the second temple is under a guy named Zerubbabel. So the people were in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. And again, this was all in the story series. They were in captivity for 70 years. And then the Persians took over, conquered the Babylonians, and allowed the Israelites to return to their land. And during the story, this was called chapter 8, Restoration. And in the restoration chapter, we said there were three returns because there were three different groups of people that were allowed to go from Babylon back to Israel. And the first group went under a guy named Zerubbabel, and they went to fix the house of worship. And so again, we talked about that. Return one was house of worship. Return two was hearts of worship. Return three was to help the walls with Nehemiah. So the first group came back to fix the house of worship, to repair the temple. And so in Ezra chapters 1 to 6 and Haggai chapters 1 to 2, you read the story of them going back to fix the temple. But what you need to remember or realize here is that Solomon was loaded. The kingdom was at the peak of, that was the best time. David and Solomon, that was the best time for the kingdom of Israel. And so now these are just kind of the leftover stragglers, and they're the first of three groups that will return. And even the third group, by the time all three groups had returned, there still was nowhere near the same amount of people that was there before the invasion. And so the first group goes back and they rebuild the temple as much as they can. And that's, again, recorded in Ezra and in Haggai. And when they were kind of done, they had a ceremony to dedicate the new temple. And Ezra chapter 3 records it this way. It says, "With praise and thanksgiving, they sang to the Lord. He is good. His love towards Israel endures forever," which is the same thing they said when Solomon, the grand opening for Solomon's temple. Now, this is Zerubbabel's temple. And they just didn't have the money. They didn't have the means. And so it says, "And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid," the foundation for the temple. Like, they're excited. Yes. It says, "But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy." So you had this mixed group of people saying, yes, worship is restored. And the young people that didn't know any better, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, they just didn't know. They were like, yes, we're finally back. We finally have the temple. We can worship. But the people that were 70 plus years old that were there the first before the captivity looked at it and were like, this is just... it's just not the same. But what is very interesting here is that we saw that the temple, when it was plundered, there is no ark anymore. So there is a holy place and a holy of holies, or a most holy place. And there is a veil and there is an altar of incense. But if you were to open the curtain to the holy of holies or the most holy place, it's empty. This is a big deal. But this is still the center of worship because the people were focused on worshiping God at a place. Because, okay, we need to worship God, but we can't get to God. We can't come to Him. His presence did not appear, did not dwell there anymore. But the ritual continues. The ritual continued. And then it actually, this second temple was destroyed by revolution. There were multiple revolutions. I don't have time to get into all that. But eventually it was destroyed by a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 BC. So that temple survived for about 500 years, but it just wasn't as great. And then we run into the third temple. And the third temple was built by Herod, also called Herod the Great. Just to be clear, this was the same Herod that killed the boys in Bethlehem. When he heard that there was some that was born the king of the Jews, where was he born? He was born in Bethlehem. He says, okay, go find him for me. Come back to the Magi. They're like, no, we're going to go a different way because God said not to go back to you. He said, okay, then we're going to kill everyone that's two and under that was living in Bethlehem. That's Herod. He was called Herod the Great because he was just kind of there are multiple Herods, but because he did a lot of things. And so he decided to rebuild the temple. He was placed there, and I don't have time to get into all the politics, but he was placed there as the Jewish king, which is why he was threatened by one king of the Jews. But he was placed there by the Roman authorities who were the ones occupying the known world at this time. So he was kind of like a sellout to the Romans. The Jews, like, yeah, stop calling yourself Jewish. I know you've got some Jewish blood in you, but dude, you're only in this position because you're like kissing up to all the Roman authorities, to the emperor. And so you've got this role, but you're not for real. So he wanted to show people how much he cared for them. He wanted to earn their love. So he spent lots of money and lots of time rebuilding the temple again for his Jewish brothers and sisters. And so the third temple takes place in the story, as we talked about, in chapter 10. Which was proclamation, which is where Jesus shows up on the scene. And so I'm just going to pause that because this matters. Because Herod starts to rebuild this temple before this guy Jesus is even born. Because he wants to earn the favor of the people. And it took almost 60 years for him to build the temple. Which, by the way, last week I said it took Solomon 8 years. It was actually 7 years to build the temple. But while this temple reconstruction is going on, we read this passage in John chapter 1. And it says, "The word Actually, the beginning of John 1 says, the Word was with God and the Word was God. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. There was this being known as the Word. And John, verse 14, chapter 1, kind of clarifies. It says, then the Word became flesh. So this God becomes flesh. This Word becomes flesh and made His dwelling among us. And I teased this a little bit last week. That Word, because this was written in Greek, that was the language that they wrote and spoke, that word means tabernacle. You could translate it, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. So God came among His people. We have seen His glory. Now we're talking about that glory word again. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth. So Herod is rebuilding this temple, and on the scene this little baby is born. The wise men say, hey, we heard one is born king of the Jews. Again, Herod's like, I'm not into that. I'm the king of the Jews. Let's kill them all so we can get them. And of course, they survived that because God said to leave Bethlehem. So that was during proclamation. So Herod's third temple. One of the things that's interesting, this is just there's not much biblical history to it. These are just all sorts of other histories that we know of the time, historical accounts of the time. But there is an interesting little note in John chapter 2, verse 20. In John chapter 2, verse 20, like I said, it took 60 years for this temple to be built. So he started to build it before Jesus was on the scene. Jesus died around 33 years of age. And it actually wasn't even done until after that. But in John 2:20, Jesus is talking to some people in the temple courts, some of the Pharisees, the religious leaders. And we're not going to get into what he talked about right now. But he was talking about the temple, and they responded to him in verse 20 and said, they replied, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, because they're in the temple. Like, it's not even done yet. And you're going to raise it in 3 days? So Herod is building this thing. Now, Herod's temple is bigger. His temple is 60 feet taller. It is just so much bigger, so much more impressive, but because he's trying to earn the favor of the Jewish people. Because they don't like him. Because he's a sellout. And so he builds this giant temple as a way to earn their respect. And of course, rebuilding the one that was the same spot where Zerubbabel's temple was, same spot where Solomon's temple was. And he was trying to build it. Now, just a little side note, after the entire old, not all of it, but after the story of the Gospels is written, this temple was destroyed by Rome in AD 70, a thing called the Abomination of Desolation. So Herod's temple didn't last too long. But this temple was incredible. So this temple, it's 11:09 a.m. So I have been teaching for about 40 minutes. Now we're into today's content. because this temple, this third temple of Herod's, is where our story picks up. So the temple was the place where people worshiped God. You can go to the next slide for me there. The temple was where the people worshiped God. That's where the Jewish people came. Now again, the priests would do their rituals over and over. Now we're talking about years, right? I mean, we're talking hundreds of years since Solomon built his temple. Almost 1,000 years before we get to the Gospels with Jesus. And one of the things you notice is that these people, these religious leaders, aren't necessarily all about worshiping God. They're all about worshiping the ritual. They do the routines. And you know what? We give the Pharisees and the religious leaders a hard time because they get caught up in just doing the things and the law and the rules and how legal they are and legalistic and all that. But they kind of had to, because the glory of the temple of the Lord wasn't there anymore. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, except that they knew what was behind the curtain. They knew who the man was, and I mean the Wizard of Oz, the green curtain. They knew that it was just a man. There's no great wizard, but they had to play along. Like, that was the best they knew. Well, this is the house, I guess, so we're going to keep doing this thing. And again, they had all sorts of issues, and it was not good. But I'm just saying, part of the reason why they got so caught up in the rituals and the rules was because they had nothing else that they could do. And so we get to this moment, and we're going to talk more about this the fifth Sunday, March, the hours before, where we're going to walk through every hour before the crucifixion of Jesus on the cross and all those events. You're not going to want to miss it. But Jesus is nailed to this cross. And he's placed on the cross, and he, as we already read, he is God in the flesh, God tabernacling among us, God with skin and bones. And he is the glory of God contained. Philippians talks about how God limited, how Jesus limited his glory. And we've talked about this before, so that people didn't die in his presence. He had to limit himself because everyone would just be dead. And again, I shared the illustration about this, about like a dad playing softball or throwing a ball with his 5-year-old kid is probably going to be different the way he plays, you know, throws the ball when he's on his softball team down at the field. You know, does it change his ability? No, but he limits his power when he's thrown to his kid than when he's throwing out on the field. Make sense? Good. That's what Jesus did. So he's on the cross. He says, I'm here to take away your sin. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. And in Mark chapter 15, verse 37 to 38, we have the very end of Jesus' life on the cross. And it says, with a loud cry, and Shelby read this for us, Jesus breathed his last. And then this thing happened, which again, if you're not familiar with the temple, if you're not familiar with all the things we've talked about these last 2 weeks, it says that then this thing happened. It's like, okay, thanks for the input. You know, that's nice. It says the curtain of the temple was torn in two. So, okay, right there, if you understand, wait a second. The curtain of the temple, this is what's dividing the access between just the common people and the holy God. No one can go past the curtain. How are you going to get to God? You can't do that. Well, this temple curtain, which is 3 inches thick, was torn in two. Oh, okay. Some guy was in there and like snip, 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 working his way through the temple. 3 inches thick, it'd be a long time. But that's not even how it goes. It says the temple was torn into, curtain of the temple was torn into from top to bottom. Anybody remember how tall I said the Herod's temple was? 60 feet. This roof is 22 feet to the peak. So basically three of that. And it tore from top to bottom. Why? Because now this Jesus has opened the way. We don't have to, as Carla prayed, we don't have to go through the ritual and the routine and have something die in our place because someone died in our place. And he says, now you've got access. You're in. You have a backstage pass. I have granted it. Jesus has granted it to us. We don't have to go through the rituals, routine. We don't have to worry about getting killed because of the glory of God, because the one who is the glory of God was killed on our behalf. And that's why the temple curtain was torn into two, to show us that we have access, that we have access to God. And so the point this week was that the torn curtain brought the people to God. See, God tore the curtain to say, look, I know I came down, my presence came down in tabernacle and temple, but now you're able to come to me. You don't have to go through the rituals and the routines because I've done it for you. I did the work. And so we have this all access pass. And again, if you were not here last week, I apologize because this is kind of a part two to what we talked about last week. And you'll probably be able to catch up, to figure out. But we talked about three different things. The first thing, we talked about how God is holy. And we talked about because of God's holiness, people could not be in the presence of God because of his glory, his holiness, similar concepts. And what we talked about last week was that the tabernacle needed a veil because of God's holiness. That's why the tabernacle had a veil. That's why the temple had a veil. But for us, God is holy, so the temple curtain was torn. We now have access. As I already said, Jesus gave us access to that. In Hebrews chapter 10, and Hebrews, like if you want to compare what Jesus did with the tabernacle temple, Hebrews chapter 10 is your place. It's just constant comparing something. Actually, the whole book of Hebrews, which was written to Jewish people that were following Christ, going, here's how this all works out. And in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 19 to 20, it says this, and so, dear brothers and sisters, we can boldly enter heaven's most holy place because of the blood of Jesus. By his death, Jesus opened a new and life-giving way through the curtain into the most holy place. He says, look, Jesus died, and now you have access, I have access. We can get to God. Before you couldn't. Before you had to keep trying, keep working, and keep doing, and hoping, and maybe this will be good enough. And Jesus says, enough. I have done it. He said on the cross, enough. How did he say it? It is finished. It's done. You now have access. Over in Ephesians, and we talked about this last month, and you can go to our Insert Name series and look our walk through the book of Ephesians the last 2 months. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 12 says, because of Christ and our faith in him, we can now come boldly and confidently into God's presence. You can come boldly into God's presence. Listen, the God of the universe says, come to you. Yeah, but what about... It's not what about, because you're not doing this by your works. You're able to go into his presence because of what Jesus has done on your behalf. So the temple curtain was torn in two. The second thing we saw is that we are dirty. And we talked about last week that the tabernacle needed that laver, which was the place where they would wash to purify themselves. But because for us, we are dirty, so Jesus purified us from sin. He cleaned us up. Hebrews chapter 10, he says, and again, the high priest, they were the ones that would go in. Well, Jesus is now our high priest on our behalf. And since we have a great high priest who rules over God's house, let us go right into the presence of God with sincere hearts, fully trusting him. Why? For our guilty consciences have been sprinkled with Christ's blood to make us clean, and our bodies have been washed with pure water. And this is the what about. Yeah, but you don't know what I've done. No, I don't. But Jesus does. And he washed you. And that regret that you have, and that mistake, and those things that you've done, and that thing that you just did 20 minutes ago that you shouldn't have done, or that thing you said on your way here to your family that you should never have opened your mouth to say, has been forgiven and washed clean. And that horrible thing that you did 6 years ago that you think no one knows about, or the way you're upset about the future, like, you're clean. Jesus did it for you. Over in Ephesians, insert name here, Paul's talking about husbands and wives, and you probably know that passage, but this is kind of a cool side of what Jesus does. Husbands are supposed to love your wives just as Christ loved the church. How did he do that? He gave up his life for her to make her holy and clean, washed by the cleansing of God's word. He did this to present her to himself as a glorious church without a spot or wrinkle or any other blemish. Instead, she will be holy and without fault. Jesus made you clean. Now, here's the deal about all this, and we'll get to the last part in a second. This, you have to use the pass. Just to say you had one at home doesn't mean like, oh yeah, okay, I'm clean. No, no, you've got to take advantage of it. You've got to use it. So you're not just clean. You're clean if you believe that Jesus has cleansed you. You're clean if you believe that he died on the cross to take away your sin. You're holy. You're able to be in God's presence because of what Jesus has done for you. And the third thing we saw was that sin is costly. And last week we talked about how the tabernacle needed an altar. And one of the things we looked at last week was that it said that day after day, people would bring an animal, and I'll share this part, that they would bring an animal, be the best animal that they had, and they'd bring it into the temple or tabernacle courts, and they would place their hands on the head of this animal. And while their hands were on the head of this animal, the priest would slit the animal's throat. And that, your hands on its head saying, this animal is dying in my place. This animal is taking the punishment for my sin. And so that animal would die there, would be sacrificed on the altar, and the blood would be sprinkled in and around the altar. One of the things we saw last week, as we wrapped it up last week, was that, and they would do this day after day after day, after year after year after year. Why? The writer of Hebrews says, because it's impossible for the blood of animals to fully take away sin. And that's why the word atonement. Atonement means to cover over. And that the top of the ark was called the atonement cover. The lid was called the atonement seat, the mercy seat, because it was covering over but not removing. It's kind of like I don't know, maybe you're a mechanic or you did some mechanicrying, and your hands are covered in oil. And when you're getting all greasy, and you know how that gets in there, it gets into your knuckles and in your fingers, and you might have to work really hard to clean them, or you could just throw on a pair of gloves. Then your hands aren't dirty, at least, you know, to the normal eye, but they haven't been actually cleansed. And that's what Jesus did. Sin is costly, so why? So Jesus sacrificed his life because the animals weren't necessary anymore. Because he did it once for all. He died as a good substitute. Because, by the way, you know, an animal isn't a perfect substitute for a human being. Because it's an animal. There's multiple reasons why this doesn't work. It'd be like, again, I've shared this before. If you had, you know, a quarter, and I said, I'll give you two shiny nickels instead of that quarter. It's 2-1. You'd be like, no. Because that's not a good substitute. It would take two shiny nickels, a dime, and another shiny nickel. Yeah, it would take all that to be a fair substitute. Well, Jesus is human, so he was a perfect substitute for us. And in Hebrews chapter 10 again, we see that under the old covenant, the priest stands and ministers before the altar day after day, offering the same sacrifices again and again, which can never take away sins. But our high priest, Jesus, who he's talking about, offered himself to God as a single sacrifice for sins, good for all time. That means all time. That means the thing, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ and you believe in his death on the cross to take away your sin, if you're saved, which is the way church people sometimes call it, if you call yourself a Christ follower, the things that you have done have been removed for all time. You cannot be unsaved. We talked about that last series. It's good for all time. Then he sat down, which is really cool too, at the place of honor at God's right hand, because sitting down in biblical terms means you're done with the work. The work is done. You sit down when you're done. There he waits until his enemies are humbled and made a footstool under his feet. He says, for by that one offering he forever made perfect those who are being made holy. It doesn't mean you're instantly perfect right now, but in God's eyes, you are seen as holy because Jesus is the one he sees. Someone has to die for your sin. Jesus did. God says, okay, who died for your sin? Okay, your animal, it's not good enough. Oh, you're working hard. Sorry, not good enough. Oh, Jesus, we're good. You now have access. In Peter records it this way, 1 Peter, he says, he personally carried our sins in his body on the cross. He carried our sins in his body so that we can be dead to sin and live for what is right. Jesus became our sacrifice. By his wounds, you are healed. So we have this all access pass. We've been granted access into the presence of God. But like I said, you have to use it. If you don't use it, it doesn't matter. Go ahead and watch this video. So Jesus died to tear the temple curtain. That's part of it, to remove our sins, but the temple curtain was torn, giving us access. And so if you guys could, all around you, there should be one of these backstage passes. If you could grab one, please make sure you've got one, because I want, there's extras up front if you need an extra one. There's some space there. If you raise your hand, maybe if you need one, and someone around you can, like, throw one at you or something. But I'd like to do me a favor. Don't put it on yet. So, this is just a piece of paper that we made up earlier this week. But it does represent something that's incredible. And that is that you and I have been given full access to God. And so, first of all, if you're a follower of Jesus here, And maybe you're like, yeah, but what about that? Like the things we were talking about. What about that? I don't know about that sin. I just want you to remember, it has all been paid in full. Jesus doesn't re-die. Jesus died once for all. And if you have placed your faith in him, you are forgiven. And so if you're a follower of Jesus, I don't want you to forget that. Stop living in the worry or the oh no. Or the, and I'm not saying don't do the right thing. Do the right thing. But we don't have to fear because it's been forgiven. And so for you, in a moment, if you're a follower of Jesus, if you've made that decision to follow him, I'm going to ask you to put this on your, put it over your neck, around your neck, over your head. Just say, yeah, okay, that's a reminder. But maybe you're here and maybe you haven't made the decision to follow Jesus. And you need to do that. And you realize that Jesus died for your sin and you have not made that decision. You're like, yeah, I've gone to church. You know what? The Pharisees, the religious leaders went and did the temple thing. But it was Jesus' death and resurrection that actually got them to heaven. It was Jesus' death that tore that temple veil. And so in your life, you need to believe that Jesus died on the cross. And as we've talked about this whole time, we are all sinners. And sinners need death. Sin requires death. And Jesus died in our place. And so if you believe that you're a sinner and you believe that Jesus died in your place, then you have been granted access to God. And that access to God to us isn't just like a, hey, now, cool. It's access to God for eternity in heaven. And so maybe as we sing this song, maybe you need to make that decision to give your life to Jesus, to turn your heart over to him. And so what I'm going to ask all of you to do in a moment, again, if you have already followed Jesus, you can just go ahead and put that backstage pass on. If you want to make that decision, I'd like to ask, and it's kind of weird, I know, but if you want to come up front and just sit here, put that badge on and take a seat in the front row during this song, and just to give me an opportunity to pray with all of you together after we continue to worship. So we're going to stand up. We're going to turn off the house lights out there. If you want to come up front and you need to say, I've never believed in what Jesus had done for me. I've never believed in his death on the cross. I've never actually taken the time to have access to God. Then just have a seat up front here. Put your backstage pass on while we sing this song together. Would you stand and worship with us?